The Senate Education Committee meeting is called to order. Today is Monday, February 8th, 2021. The time is 9:01. We are meeting in the State Capitol Room number 205. In attendance is Vice Chair Senator Stevens, Senator Hughes, on my right, Senator Machicki, Senator Begich, and myself, Senator Holland, Chair. Thank you to Jeannie, our recording secretary, and Kelsey, our moderator today. As a reminder, please silence your cell phones. This week, we will dive into some of the questions that members raised earlier in this committee. Specifically, we'll focus on the funding and learning impacts of COVID-19 on K-12 education in Alaska. This topic is timely and important as we navigate this pandemic. My goal is to identify any unresolved issues that require immediate attention, but also to capture any positive changes that we can use to improve the learning environment for our children. We start this week with an overview from the Department of Education. We welcome Commissioner Johnson, Heidi Teschner, Lacey Sanders, and Erin Harden to the committee via video conference today. Commissioner, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your presentation.
For the record, my name is Michael Johnson, Commissioner of the Department of Education and Early Development. Good morning, committee. Thank you, Chair Holland, for the opportunity to participate again today in the Senate Education Committee hearing. Next slide.
One moment, please. Slide number two.
All right, as noted, today we're going to provide you with information related to this year's student count and the changes compared to last year, as well as information related to the almost $200 million in education-related COVID relief funds from the federal government. Next slide.
Slide number three.
In unprecedented times, it's important to remind ourselves of our destination, which is an excellent education for every student every day, regardless of our circumstances. And today's hearing is about just that, reminding ourselves that even though the circumstances have been challenging, our destination, our goal is still the same, and that is an excellent education for every student. Next slide.
With no questions, slide number four.
As we identify the impact of COVID-19 and the impact of millions of dollars in relief funds, it's also important to remind ourselves of our shared priorities, which I think provides us a post-pandemic pathway for our education system. Those five, as we noted in our first hearing, is to support all students to read at grade level by the end of third grade, to increase career, technical, and culturally relevant education opportunities to meet student and workforce needs, to close the achievement gap by ensuring equitable educational rigor and resources, to prepare, attract, and retain effective education professionals, and of course, to improve the safety and well-being of our students through school partnerships with families, communities, and tribes. Next slide.
Slide number five.
Thank you. Chair Holland and committee, we have the good fortune indeed to have two of the most experienced finance experts in our state, Lacey Sanders, Director of Administrative Services, and Heidi Heschner, Director of School Finance and Facilities. Together, these ladies handle one of the largest portions of our state's budget, and they are uniquely equipped and qualified to provide you with both current and past budgetary and enrollment context that you'll need going forward. So right now I'm going to turn it over to Heidi for the first portion of the hearing. Thank you.
Ms. Teschner, please repeat your affiliation for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner, and good morning, Chair Holland and members of the Senate Education Committee. For the record, my name is Heidi Teschner, and I am the Director of Finance and Support Services with the Department of Education and Early Development. This morning, I am going to provide the committee with an overview of our fiscal year 2021 statewide enrollment updates. and explain the foundation payment process and address a few additional state-funded programs that are affected by the enrollment counts. Next slide, please.
Slide number six.
So the legislature has provided a formula and statute for funding school operational costs, and this is known as the public school funding formula, but more commonly known as the foundation formula. The foundation formula was adopted under Senate Bill 36 in 1998 and implemented in 1999, and it is defined in Alaska Statute Title 14, Chapter 17. The funding for each district is a combination of state aid, required local contribution, and federal impact aid. Note that the regional educational attendance areas, are commonly known as REAAs, do not have a local contribution, and also there are 19 REAA school districts in Alaska. Furthermore, there is one school district that does not receive a local contribution or impact aid, so their funding is solely based on state aid, and that is the Southeast Island School District. A school district is only eligible for foundation funding as calculated under the formula and set out in Alaska Statute 14-17-410. And as the first step in determining state aid for a school district, that is, we determine the average daily membership or ADM of each school. Next slide, please.
Question from Senator Hughes.
Yes, thank you for being with us today, Heidi. In the last 22 years, how many times has that the funding formula been adjusted, and when was the most recent time? And the reason I ask is because I understand, I believe through NCSL, I remember hearing that in other states, it's not uncommon for them to tweak their formula every year or two, and I don't have the impression that we look at ours as often. So when it was, how many times, and when was the last time?
Great question through the chair, Senator Hughes. I don't have the exact number in front of me, and I'm sorry for that, but it has been, I would say, anywhere like 10 times approximately, and it's been changed over the year by increasing, adjusting our district cost factors, adjusting the special education intensive factor to most recently, it was 13 times, and then adjusting the correspondence factor from 80% to the current 90%. Sorry, off the top of my head, I'm not remembering the exact, but I can get back to the committee on the exact last update.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
You're welcome.
A question from Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just actually a note for the Agenbleck study that was done by the legislature to review the formula was done in 2015, though, correct, Heidi, Ms. Teschner?
Through the chair, that sounds accurate, yes.
Yeah. So, Mr. Chairman, the legislature under Co-Chair McKinnon of the Finance Committee requested an audit done and a review done, about $250,000 review of the formula. That was done by a group out of Colorado called Agenbleck. I can get a copy of the study to the committee members for the review, but that study reviewed our formula program at that time as part of a regular process and concluded that the formula, with the exception of some changes that were made in the subsequent years, was generally in pretty robust shape. And so I'm happy to provide that. And I know that Senator McKinnon actually adjusted some of the elements of the formula related to how we reimburse schools that have fallen below a certain number. I can't remember, Ms. Teschner, do you remember the law that passed? I think it was in either 2017 or 2018. Senator McKinnon championed that adjusted for school population declines. That was a direct result of Agenbleck.
Through the chair, Senator Begich, that was the consolidation, implementing a statute to address the consolidation of schools. Within a district's choice.
Mr. Chairman, if I may just, that was a direct response from the Agenbleck study, which was designed to create what was identified as a mistake in the formula. So the process is somewhat robust. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Begich. Question from Senator Machicki.
Yeah, just to actually dovetail on both questions and comments. Alaska legislature lives in fear of even considering readjusting the BSA, and I think in order to move forward, if we can get a comprehensive listing of the changes plus the study, that would be really helpful for us as we analyze potential paths forward.
Thank you, Senator Machicki.
Absolutely, we can provide that to the committee.
All right, with no more questions, it looks like we're in slide number 7.
Thank you, Chair. So the average daily membership, or the ADM, it is a defined term for student count data and is the number of students that are enrolled during the 20-day school count period that ends the fourth Friday in October. For fiscal year, or for the school year 2020-2021, that school 20-day count period ran from September 28th and ended on October 23rd, 2020. In order to determine the state aid, districts must submit their student count data or their average daily membership to the department within 2 weeks after the count period ends. And this is in accordance with Alaska Statute 1417-600A. For the 2020-2021 school year, that count period data was due to the department in November 6, 2020. Thus, based on statute, the count data is the student data is from the count period is the starting point for determining how you calculate state aid for school districts. Next slide, please.
Proceed with slide number 8.
Thank you. The table at the top of slide 8 shows the statewide fiscal year 2021 OASIS update data. This is as of December 18th, 2020, and it compares the student data to the 21 projected student count data and the 2020 actual count data. The fiscal year 22 projected data is also shown in this table, and we compare that against the 21 OASIS update numbers. And just for reference, I'll explain what each of these columns are. So the fiscal year 21 projected data, that's data that the districts provided to the department in November of 2019 in accordance with Alaska Statute 1417-500. These counts were used in order to prepare the governor's fiscal year 21 budget. That projected data is used for budgeting purposes only at the statewide level. At the November 18th, 2020 joint education hearing, the department provided the joint committee, education committees, with the 21 preliminary data, which was the unreconciled data that the department submitted as a result of the 20-day count period that ended in October. That preliminary data was subject to change after the department's review, and that review process included clearing all duplications, ensuring that no student received more than one average daily membership count, and then our special education intensive reviews. So the fiscal year 21 OASIS update numbers is the result of that review, and those results, we cleared all of the duplicates, again, ensuring no student received more than one ADM. And just for reference for the committee, we had over 1,500 duplicates, so this was a total from all districts, and so about half of that was about 768 roughly unique student ID numbers that were duplicated in the system. And that is doubles basically what we've had in previous years. In addition, the department is still in the process of reviewing our special education intensive student counts, so those, any changes as a result of that could still come forward, but the ADM numbers, as I'm presenting to you today, are pretty much final. It's the final dollar amount that could be subject to change still. And then the fiscal year 2022 projected data, that's the data that districts submitted to the department in November of 2020, and it was used in order to prepare the governor's fiscal year 22 budget. And now I want to just provide a closer look at the count data that you're seeing at the table on top of slide 8. The fiscal year 21 OASIS regular ADM, this is the brick and mortar students, that decreased 15,352.91, or about 13.4% 3% compared to our fiscal year 21 projected data. And then the fiscal year 21 OASIS correspondence ADM has increased 13,445.80, or a 94.9% increase over the fiscal year 21 projected data. The overall total ADM has decreased only 1,907.11, or 1.5%, comparing it to the fiscal year 21 projected.
Mr.
I also want to point out that the adjusted average daily membership has increased 5,698.09, or 2.2%, compared to the fiscal year 21 projected. Slide 10 of this presentation provides a glance at the factors used to determine the adjusted ADM, but for a quick reference here, that includes applying the school size factor to the count, addressing hold harmless, followed by the district cost factors, a special needs factor, the vocational education, technical education factor, special education intensives, and our correspondence ADM. We'll address that a little bit more in a couple slides. But the adjusted for school size ADM, the hold harmless provision and the shift in correspondence are the main reasons that are attributing to this increase that you're seeing in adjusted average daily membership.
A question from Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yep. Director Teschner, does the decline of 1907, which is effectively saying we have roughly 2,000 fewer students being counted, we know that some of that's because of the out-migration in Alaska that's occurred, raising population level. But is any of that people who've slipped through the cracks? Do you have any way of analyzing that? I mean, are we missing some students because they're neither in our correspondence program nor in our brick-and-mortar schools? Have we lost students lost them not because of population declines but for other reasons?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, we did do an analysis to figure out where students might have gone. We do, unless they're enrolled in a public school, whether that's a brick-and-mortar school or a public correspondence school, we don't know if they have left the state or if they have left to go to a private homeschool program or another private school. So with what we were able to determine is that there are fractional ADMs more so than has been in recent years, and that, you can have an upwards of four student ID numbers that equal one full ADM. If they're each a quarter time, that would just be a one. There's also from the analysis that staff were able to get, there was almost 12,000 new Alaska student ID numbers that were assigned since last year. And a lot of those are to the pre-Ks, the kindergartners, and the first graders. There is obviously the students that have left the state because they graduated last year, but beyond that, we don't know exactly how many students have gone to a private school or have moved out of state.
Thank you.
Thank you. With no more questions, proceed.
And we can move on to slide 9.
Slide up. A quick question from Senator Hughes.
Yeah, I just thought of, as you were stating that, when students leave, is there any process where, as they exit the school, that they're asked where they're heading or where they're going, or do all of a sudden, just one day, the kids don't show up and the parents have moved away or the parents have put the child in a private school? Is there any kind of exit interview or any data collected, and is that something that might be helpful?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, so I know that there is, if a student is transferring from one school to another, there usually is transfer paperwork that the exiting school sends to the new school district. So I would assume that is the same process for a private school if they left the public and went to a private, but I don't know that for a fact. That might be a really good question to ask the school districts that'll be before you later this week, because it might be different across districts.
And a question from Senator Stevens.
Well, I just want to point out that this is an enormous problem, and it'll have major repercussions on the school districts and on the department in the future. I've heard superintendents talk about ghost students. I've heard my grandchildren talk about students that were in their class that just disappeared, and they were working online, and the students have never shown up again. So, I mean, I just want to point out, it should be patently obvious to everyone, this is an enormous problem we're facing, all of these ghost students. And what are we going to do with them? How are we going to prepare for them? How are we going to make sure this is not a lost year for them? And anyway, I just point out the obvious. Thank you.
Yes.
And a question from Senator Machicki.
Thank you. Ms. Teschner, just trying to understand the adjusted ADM. So if you think about how the hold harmless provision on the 5 year for 5% or more being at 75% the first year, if the impacts of COVID were to continue throughout FY21, and you drop down to the 50%, this bottom line number is going to look much different, isn't it?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, and slide 9 will walk us through a little bit more on the hold harmless provision. But yes, if the trends were to continue, they that line for in fiscal year 22 is projected could change, and then that is also subject to change based on the actual count that we will get next October of 21.
Do you have, Mr. Chairman, if I may?
Yes. Follow up from Senator Machicki.
Have you calculated that out, if the trend continues, what that looks like? Is that something you'd be willing to share, even if you average the change over 2 years, expecting some improvement? Once you get into the 50% in the second year, do you have some analysis what that funding difference may look like?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, we haven't done any, say, comparison projected other than the projected data that is presented on this slide, that if the trends were to continue, or this is, we're having districts project that they'll either have additional, the students will come back to their brick and mortar versus their correspondence, or they'll stay in correspondence as it is right now. So we have a mixture. If they were to move and continue to stay below the base year, which we'll talk a little bit more about hold harmless in a moment, but if they stay below that, then that 50% calculation would already be in that projected number reflected.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. With one more question from Senator Hughes.
Yes, and I want to make sure I'm not thinking of this incorrectly, Heidi, so if you'd help me. So if there are 10 students that had been in brick and mortar schools and they moved over and went to public correspondence and school, so then they're getting the 90% rate. And if we hold the district harmless for the regular ADM, in a sense, we're paying for those students twice, once at the full rate and once at the 90% rate. Is that correct?
Senator, through the chair, Senator Hughes, that is, yes. And we have districts that have experienced that. Mat-Su, for example, they lost kids in their brick and mortars because they went to the Mat-Su Central School. And so they triggered hold harmless, and they're also getting paid for those students through the correspondence factor.
Okay, thank you.
With no more questions, I believe we're on slide 9.
Correct. So I'm going to address now just the hold harmless provision and just give the committee a background on that. So the provision itself was enacted in 2008 under House Bill 273, and it was for those districts that were experiencing a reduction in their brick and mortar schools average daily membership after it has been adjusted for school size. So eligibility is determined after the district's adjusted for school size average daily membership is calculated and totaled up for all schools. So it's a district-wide total, not by school. The sum total of the district's adjusted for school size average daily membership is compared to the prior fiscal year's total adjusted for school size ADM to determine if a decrease of 5% or greater has occurred. So if that answer is yes, then the prior fiscal year is looked at as the base year for the next 3 years. The new school size adjusted with Hold Harmless continues through the formula adjustments, which we'll address briefly on the next slide. This approximate results in approximately 75% of the basic need calculation being restored in the first year. The Hold Harmless provision is available to school districts over a three-year step down of 75% in the first year, 50% in the second year, and 25% in the final year, provided that the adjusted for school size ADM stays below that established base year. And this three-year step down allows time for districts' budgets to adjust to the decreased funding that comes with the reduction in their brick and mortar school ADM. I will also note that, you know, if they triggered Hold Harmless in 21 and they had another 5% decrease in fiscal year 22 when their actuals come in, as we're comparing it, if that they have a choice, they can then either continue the trend of 50%, or they can restart their Hold Harmless. It's really a case by case. We work with the districts and they usually choose the higher of the two amounts. And that is this slide, so unless there's questions.
A question from Senator Machicki.
Ms. Teschner, if the first year that you start your 5% is your base year for the next 3 years, if you choose the calculation on the second year 5% reduction, do you reset to that year's base?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki. So if 21, so if for in 21, fiscal year 21, we're comparing against 20. So 20 is our base year. In 22, if they experience an additional 5% decrease in their school size adjusted, that base year then becomes 21, and then they can start the 75% in 22, or continue on with the 50% and keeping 20 as the base year.
Thank you. Looks like no more questions.
And with that, we can move on to slide 10.
Slide 10.
So on slide 10, we are providing just kind of like the outline of the formula for the committee. So after the student data is reported, that average daily membership for each school is next calculated by applying the school size factor to that count according to the table in Alaska Statute 1417.410. And then the product of that calculation is then used as a factor in the next step of the formula. All in all, Alaska Statute 1417.410 sets out all of the remaining steps, and on this slide, you can see that we have given you the statutory reference for each factor for your quick reference to see. The tables on both slides 10 and 11 provide the committee with that glance at the whole overview, whole formula components and the multipliers that we use to determine state aid. So just on slide 10 is what we get to our district adjusted average daily membership. So we have we take the ADM and we apply it through the school size factor table. And then between these two, between the district cost factor and the school size table, is where you would apply the Hold Harmless provision. And from there, we would then take the district cost factor that's set out in statute, then multiply that by the special needs factor, then the vocational education factor, the special education intensives, and then applying the correspondence average daily membership. And then, if there's no specific questions, we can move on to slide 11, which finishes the formula and shows the funding side. So once we have our district adjusted average daily membership, we multiply that by the base student allocation, which is $5,930, and that gives us our basic need. And then there are three components that pay for basic need. It's the required local contribution, impact aid, and then we have our state aid. And then we add our quality schools and we get the total state entitlement. I wanted to also point out to the committee that we have a document on our website called the Public School Funding Program Overview. It's about an 8-page document that outlines each of these in more detail, and we can provide that to the committee. But also wanted to point that out, that we have and can get go into more detail on each of these if there are questions.
With no questions.
Okay, we can move on to slide 11. 12, sorry.
Slide 12.
Yes. So back on slide 8, we talked about the top part of this table, so I'm not going to focus on that here. I would more like to address the bottom side. The funding side, the bottom portion of this. So our fiscal year 21 OASIS update numbers compared to the 21 projected numbers, showing a net increase of $25 million and some change, or 2% increase. And note that this is a $25 million increase over the current year's budget. And within these numbers, there are, I just want to point out to the committee that 25 school districts are estimated to receive increased state aid, and that totals approximately $54.5 million, and that compares to the remaining 29 districts that are estimated to receive decreased state aid, totaling approximately $29.4 million. And when you net these two together, that's where we get the $25 million increase. The OASIS 21 fiscal year 21 OASIS update versus 2020 actual is showing a net increase of $38.1 million, or a 3.1% increase over what we were paid out last school year. And within those numbers, 35 school districts are estimated to receive increased state aid, totaling approximately $56.1 million. And then the remaining 19 school districts estimating to receive decreased state aid of approximately $21.3 million. And this is the statewide data. And I wanted to point out that later on in your slide deck, there is a closer look at the average daily membership and foundation counts, as well as the COVID-19 federal relief funding and our fiscal year 2020 operating fund balance. Data for the 11 school districts you'll hear from on Wednesday and Friday of this week. And we'll address those as we get to them, but I just wanted to point out we're giving you school-level data as well as the statewide data. And if there's no questions on slide 12, we can go to the next slide.
Question from Senator Hughes.
Just so I make sure I understand, so that increase of $38 million, that does not include any federal COVID dollars coming to the districts?
Through the chair, yes, that is correct. That is just the increase from student enrollment.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
With no other questions, slide 13, I believe.
Slide 13, correct. So on this slide, I just kind of wanted to provide the committee with an overview of how our foundation payments are processed. So Alaska Statute 1417-610A outlines that process. And what the department follows in order to get state aid out to districts. So payments are processed on a monthly basis and are timed to arrive in the district's bank account by the 15th of each month. Payments for the first 9 months of the fiscal year are calculated based on the prior fiscal year's foundation. So for fiscal year 21, these first 9 months, July through March, are paid on the final fiscal year 2020 foundation. The remaining 3 months, April, May, and June, are recalculated and trued up based on the finalized current year foundation counts. So again, for fiscal year 21, these last 3 months will be based on the finalized fiscal year 21 foundation counts. And this ensures that when the fiscal year ends, a district is paid what they are due for that current year. So again, for fiscal year 21. And it's based on their actual reconciled ADM counts. And if there's no questions on this slide, we can go to the next slide.
Question from Senator Vachicki.
Thank you, Ms. Teschner. You referred to AS 1417-610A, which is actually the, if I'm understanding this correctly, the $38 million increase and not the $44 million decrease, is that correct?
Correct. And actually, so what we're doing through the chair, Senator Vachicki, I'm gonna go back to that so make sure I'm answering this correctly. So We've been paying based on 20 actuals. We are going to true it up. So it's actually the $25 million that we're going to true up increase for the April, May, and June payments.
Thank you. With no more questions, slide 14, I believe.
Slide 14, yes. And this is, I just wanted to provide the committee with the other state-funded programs that will also be affected. And they use the 2020-21 student enrollment data in order to determine their final fiscal year 21 grant amounts. So those include the pupil transportation program and the residential schools program. So on slide 14, I'm providing that on the top of it, top of slide 14, our pupil transportation grant. That's determined based on a statutory formula, and that's in Alaska Statute 1409010, which is we take the district's average daily membership less their correspondence average daily membership, and we multiply that by the per student account amount that is set out in statute. For fiscal year 21's appropriation was almost $77 million. The estimated 21 actual grants is estimated to be about $65.3 million, so an $11.65 million, million dollar or 15% decrease over the prior year, over the current year budget. So obviously, less students in brick and mortar is going to mean less dollars to districts for their pupil transportation program.
Senator Begich.
Is there a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just I was reflecting on the pupil transportation. We pay a bus rate that is figured as a cost factor related to minimum wage, and so I just wanted to point out, while I have generally supported a minimum wage increase, Mr. Chairman, it would have a dramatic impact on the bus wages and would have a dramatic impact on this number, wouldn't it, if the minimum wage was raised significantly?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, if the minimum, that would be at the district level. The grant, the department's grant amount won't change unless statute is changed to reflect that. But when a district renews their contract, they would then have to apply the minimum wage factor. The increased minimum wage is based on how it's written. And then if it's a school district operated program, they would it would be an immediate increase. So it would be a hit to a district's pupil transportation program. But the program that the grant the department pays out will continue as is with no adjustment unless a statute is amended.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, just
follow up from Senator Begich.
Part of this is just to make sure we're all aware of unintended consequences of actions, even if well-intended actions. My well-intended action could have an unintended consequence that could harm school districts. So I want to be careful that we watch for that to see whether it comes from the federal level or whether it comes at the local level, that we are aware that this could the way it works is usually a contract for a bus driver is a factor of whatever the existing minimum wage is, and the Alaska minimum wage is driven by the federal minimum wage to some degree. So wanted to put that on the table, just something for all of us to be aware of as all those different things move forward.
Thank you, Senator Begich. With no more questions, do you have one?
I can wait till she goes through the residential schools program, and then I'll have a question.
Okay. Proceed, Ms. Teschner.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. So I'm going to move to the bottom of slide 14 and address the residential schools program. So the funding for this program is also determined by a statutory formula, and that's set out in Alaska Statute 1416200. And that funding is also outlined on slide 14 with it between two parts. So there's a residential stipend. That is a per pupil monthly stipend rate that we multiply by 9 months, and then that's multiplied by the actual student count. In addition, they get a one round trip transportation reimbursement per student, and that must be at the least expensive means between the student's community of residence and the school. So for fiscal year 21, the appropriation for the residential schools program was approximately $8,275,700. the estimated fiscal year 21 actual grants total is $2,363,600. So it's a decrease of $5.9 million or 71%. In a normal year, there are 9 school districts that operate 10 approved programs across the state. And in, for this year, only 4 residential schools were up and operating, but at a reduced capacity. So Galena, which is a year-long program, has 47 students attending, but they're approved for up to 210 students. So they're seeing a 78% decrease in their student population this year. Lower Yukon, they're a variable term program, and they have 42 students attending. They are approved up to 50, so they are seeing a 16% decrease. Nanana, they are a year-long program, and so they have 49 students attending this year. And they are approved up to 100 maximum students, and so they're seeing about a 51% decrease in their population this year. And then Northwest Arctic, which is both a variable term and a year-long program, they only have 8 students attending, and they are approved up to 40 maximum, and so an 80% decrease. So all of this is contributing to, obviously, less money going out in that program.
First, a question from Senator Baczycki.
Yeah, I guess I would like to understand, Ms. Teschner, how it, so after the hold harmless on 610A and the lack of protection under pupil transportation of residential schools, do you have a breakdown on how, what the funding differences look like for each of the districts that we can look at as we're evaluating funding path forward this year before COVID relief? It would be really nice to understand. I'm sure it affects every district very differently, and it would be nice to understand that impact on the individual districts.
Through the chair, absolutely, we can provide that to the committee.
Thank you.
And a question from Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Heidi, the I'm just looking at that number. That number is an anomaly, really related to the COVID-19 outbreak and the lack of transportation. I mean, people not going to these schools because of safety issues. This, you don't expect this anomaly to be retained, do you, if the COVID-19 pandemic is largely under control?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, if the trend is that districts or students will go back to the brick and mortar schools, then they're that, you know, the this is an anomaly. This decrease in pupil transportation would only occur this year. And we would see fiscal year 22 go back up.
I meant the residential school program. Sorry, Mr. Chairman. I meant the residential school program.
No worries. Through the chair, Senator Begich, same thing. I would assume that if everything gets resolved and schools open back up to full capacity, this reduced amount that they're getting just for the residential stipend part of their funding for the residential school itself, that would go back up to normal levels, and they would be at full capacity or close to it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. A question from Senator Hughes.
Yes, thank you, Heidi. So because of COVID-19, the what happened with the residential school program, where maybe only, I don't know what the number is, 30% of what was appropriated was spent because students weren't in the residential schools. I would have thought the same kind of thing for pupil transportation because so many of the brick and mortar schools were closed. Were there contracts for bus drivers that were being paid even though schools were closed and students were not being transported? I'm just surprised that it was $65 million out of 76, when my understanding is most of the school districts had their brick and mortar schools closed.
So through the chair, Senator Hughes, the pupil transportation grant, that is based on a statutory formula. So whether the schools are open or not, the department, assuming we have a legislative appropriation, we would pay based on that statute. So we base it on their brick and mortar students multiplied by their per student cost. Yes, there are still pupil transportation costs within districts, even if they're not running. Typically, pupil transportation contracts have a clause that you pay at a reduced rate if you're not running buses. Each district's contract is a little bit different, so I don't have specifics on each of them. And then, obviously, if it's a district-run pupil transportation program, it would be slightly different. And so if the district is choosing to still pay their bus drivers, they which we encourage them to continue doing, assuming that school can open and we want like bus drivers to be there to transport our students. That's entirely up to the district. So I hope that answers your question.
Well, I've got a follow-up to that.
Follow-up from Senator Hughes.
So the amount calculated automatically goes to the school districts, and then whether a school district is paying a diminished rate if the buses aren't running or not is up to each school, and it might vary. But if that money is automatically going to the district and they aren't paying, let's say they aren't, are they allowed to use that funds for something else? So would we be seeing pupil transportation money possibly being used in districts for other purposes?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, yes, unfortunately you would. So we would obviously pay for the pupil transportation program. They would reflect that in their special revenue fund for the pupil transportation program. And then they would need to show a transfer out to another fund, back to the operating fund, if they, as an example, to be used on something else. Now, we're not going to be able to see what that specific purchase is if they moved it back to, say, their special or their operating fund, but you would see that they removed money from pupil transportation and put it into operating.
Follow up from Senator Hughes.
Do we know how much of that $65 million was not used for pupil transportation?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, we don't have 21s. We're still in fiscal year 21. So until we get their audit, which would be next in November of 21, we don't know exactly how much of their funding is transferred out of their pupil transportation funds. We can go back and share data from prior fiscal years, 21 or fiscal year 20 or prior, but not fiscal year 21 yet, unfortunately.
Okay, thank you.
Director Teschner, if I understand correctly, some of the schools might have lost enrollment but stayed open. I believe I remember in a previous committee meeting where the mention was made that they were still transporting students, just less students. They had to run the same routes to pick up the kids. Is that a correct recollection?
Senator Chair Hollins, yes, that is correct. There are districts that were still up and operating, just at a reduced ridership. And you'll have districts tell you, and you know, potentially later this week, that you know they still have the costs, even if their route costs aren't going to change, just because they have 5 students instead of 10, as an example. It still costs to run the bus.
With no more questions, I believe we're on slide 15, if you're ready to move on.
Yes, and that actually concludes my portion of the presentation this morning, and I'm going to pass it on to Lacey Sanders, who will address the COVID-19 federal relief money.
Thank you, Ms. Teschner. Ms. Sanders, if you'd like to repeat your affiliation and for the record, and begin your presentation on slide 15.
Yes, of course. Good morning. Can you hear me?
Just fine.
Great. Good morning again. For the record, my name is Lacey Sanders. I am the Admin Services Director for the Department of Education and Early Development. Today, I will be providing an update on the COVID-19 federal relief packages that have been allocated to the State of Alaska Department of Education and Early Development. I'll be starting on slide 16 of the presentation. The Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, also known as the CARES Act, was signed into law on March 27, 2020, and appropriated $30.75 billion into the Education Stabilization Fund. The funding was allocated as follows: approximately $1.4 billion into the Elementary and Secondary School Emergency Relief Fund, or ESSER 1 Fund, approximately $13.5 billion into the Governor's Emergency Education Relief Fund, or GEAR 1 Fund, and approximately $14.25 billion into the Higher Education Emergency Relief Fund. I will be speaking today about ESSER and GEAR funds, and the University of Alaska is the most appropriate agency to speak about the Higher Education Emergency Relief Funds. Moving on to slide 17.
Please proceed.
Thank you. This slide represents the state of Alaska's allocation of CARES Act ESSER 1 and GEAR 1 funds. The total allocation of ESSER 1 funds was $38.4 million. It was allocated into two separate parts, the first being to local education agencies, which are the school districts. They were awarded $34.6 million, or 90% of the funding. The funding is then allocated to school districts based on the Title I, Part A of Elementary Secondary Education Act. This funding is available for school districts to obligate until September 30th, 2022. As of January 29th, 2021, school district requested reimbursements totaling $11.3 million. School districts provide an application and budget for each fiscal year. FY 2020 was the first year they did this, and the department is currently working on the applications and budget requests for FY 2021. The department provides reimbursements as requests are received, and this process will continue into FY 22 and FY 2023. The second portion was the State Education Agency funding, or the Department of Education and Early Development, which received $3.8 million to grant awards or contracts to address emergency needs resulting from the COVID-19 pandemic. One half of 1% may be used for administrative costs. This funding is also available through September 30th, 2022. The total allocation of GEAR 1 funding is $6.5 million, and the purpose of this funding is to provide emergency assistance as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. This funding is available for the governor to allocate at his discretion, and the governor did allocate the funding as follows. $3.7 million was allocated to school districts, $1.7 million was allocated to institutes of higher education, and $1.7 million as a competitive grant award to education and education-related entities. Are there any questions on this slide?
With no questions, please proceed.
Thank you. Moving on to slide 18, and this summarizes the newer relief package that was recently passed, the Coronavirus Response and Relief Supplemental Appropriations Act, also known as the CERSA Act. This act was signed into law on December 27, 2020, and it appropriated approximately $82 billion into the Education Stabilization Fund, and was allocated as follows. Approximately $4.1 billion into the Governor's Emergency Education Relief 2 Fund, or GEAR 2 Fund. Approximately $54.3 billion into the Elementary and Secondary School Emergency Relief Fund, or ESSER 2 Fund. And $21.7 billion into the Higher Education Emergency Relief Fund. Again, I will only be speaking on ESSER 2 and GEAR 2. They do have a different reference because the funding is accounted for separately from CARES Act. They have different uses, available uses, and different period of availability.
Question from Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to the Chair. Lacey, I'm looking, as I recall, the CARES Act money wasn't allowed to supplant funding, but the ESSER money does allow for supplementing and is not limited in the supplanting role. Could you go into a little more detail about that so all the members of the committee are aware of the difference? Because I think it recognizes the length of the pandemic's impact on school districts. I think it's worth people knowing a little bit about the difference between the supplanting and the supplementing, which is what the current funding does. That allows for supplemental funding.
Through the chair, Senator Begich, you are correct. The CARES Act did not allow for supplementing, not supplanting. So school districts could not utilize the funding in the same manner as the CERSA funding allows for maximum flexibility in the future years. I am not an expert on supplements, not supplants. I don't want to speak too broadly on that. If it would be okay with Senator Begich, I can follow up with the committee with additional information.
That would be fine. With no more questions, please proceed.
Okay. Moving on to slide 19. I will start with the state of Alaska's allocation of SR2 funding. The total allocation of SR2 was $159.7 million. Again, local education agencies or the school districts were awarded the largest proportion of this funding, $143.7 million. As I mentioned earlier, this has a longer period of availability. Funding is available for school districts to obligate until September 30th, 2023, and may be used for expenditures dating back to March 2020. The department is currently working on the application for this funding, and we anticipate that it will be available to school districts in mid-February, so shortly here. And the state education agency also received $15.2 million to award grants or contracts. Again, a small portion of this funding may be used for administrative costs, and this funding is also available through September 30th, 2023. SR2 does have an expanded list of allowable activities compared to the CARES Act, including allowing funding to be used to address learning loss, summer programming such as summer school, and school facility repairs that reduce the risk of virus transmission and improving air quality. During the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee on January 18th, 2021, several legislators had questions about water system upgrades and investments in internet or broadband infrastructure. Federal guidance does provide the following allowances on this money. Specifically to broadband and infrastructure, it allows for purchasing educational technology, including software, hardware, and connectivity for students who are served by the local education agency that aids in the regular and substantive educational interaction between the students and their classroom instructors, including low-income students and children with disabilities, which may include assistive technology, adaptive equipment, as well as planning for, coordinating, and implementing activities during the long-term closures, including providing meals for eligible students, providing technology for online learning to all students, and providing guidance for carrying out requirements under the IDEA and ensuring other educational services can continue to be provided consistent with all federal, state, and local requirements. Regarding water system upgrades, the federal guidance does allow for school facility repairs and improvements to enable operation of schools to reduce the risk of virus transmission and exposure to environmental health hazards and to support student health needs. I would like to note that school districts do determine how the funding will be used. The department reviews the school district's proposed plans and requests for reimbursements to ensure they are for allowable uses. DEED assists all school districts in determining what those allowable uses are and ensure that they are based on federal guidance. And the department also provides frequently asked questions, documents on our website to allow for all school districts to receive the same response. Any questions?
One question from Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a point on this air quality and school facilities piece. A lot of the major maintenance list for years has had HVAC systems and those kinds of things listed. And those obviously preceded the COVID-19, but clearly would be impacted by COVID-19. So the HVAC system improvements on those major maintenance list, those kinds of projects would be eligible under this funding, would they not?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, yes, as long as they are meeting that guidance, which says to reduce the risk of virus transmission and exposure to environmental health standards. Again, I just want to reiterate that the school districts are the ones that will decide, you know, how their funding will be spent. It is not something that the department can tell the school district to do. Although we are happy to help them find allowable uses for that funding.
Thank you.
Any more questions? Senator Stevens?
The summer programming is crucial, it seems to me, to catch students who have fallen through the cracks, and there seems to be a lot of them. I understand what you're saying is that that money goes to the districts themselves, and they determine how that is to be used. I'm just concerned about the involvement of the department in that. Are you going to have additional staff? Are you going to be making recommendations, or is it, are you leaving it totally in the hands of the district?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, regarding the school district's money, yes, they are the ones that will decide how their funding will be utilized. I know the State Department of Education is working on, as part of the governor's State of the State address, mentioning, you know, addressing the learning loss, and the department is working on ways that we can meet that summer learning loss as well.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, I think that's a really crucial issue, and it seems to me the department needs to be directly involved in that. So I'd appreciate it as we move along that you keep us abreast of what's going on and how the department is attempting to coordinate the summer programs throughout the state.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, absolutely.
With no more questions, please proceed.
Okay. I will be moving on to slide number 20. Slide 20 is represents the state of Alaska's allocation of Gear 2 funding. The total award was just under $8.2 million. This is broken into two pieces. The first is the governor's supplemental allocation of $2.8 million. This is the similar to the Gear 1 funding that I mentioned earlier. The allowable uses are similar, and they include preventing, preparing for, and responding to COVID-19. The governor has discretion on awarding this funding and has not provided guidance at this time. The second portion of this funding is a new provision. It's titled Emergency Assistance for Non-Public Schools, or EANS, and the total allocation to the state of Alaska is $5.4 million. This funding will be awarded to non-public schools in partnership with the State Department of Education and Early Development. We anticipate the application for this funding will be available by the deadline of February 12, 2021. Non-public schools are not required to register with the State Department of Education and Early Development, making it difficult to provide a comprehensive list of eligible schools. Included in your packet should be a handout number 5. Which does list the number of school or list the schools that have been identified as non-public schools in Alaska. DEED conducted an extensive search, including contacting local school districts, searching websites, and searching other state databases. Once the application period is available, there may be additional eligible schools that are identified. Are there any questions?
With no questions, please proceed.
Thank you. Slide 21 represents the overall funding. It's just a visual for you that the state has received for education. On one side, you have ESSER, and the other side, you have GEAR in total. I would like to note that we have provided several backup documents for your reference. In your packet, you should have a DEED handout 1, which is a summary of the total allocation by school district from both the CARES and the CERSA Act. In addition, we have provided a DEED handout 2, which is a summary of the total funds expended by school districts under the CARES Act and includes a total percentage expended. Lastly, you should have two additional handouts, DEED handout number 3 and DEED handout number 4, that provide a deeper dive on how the school districts are spending their funds. The handout number 3 is specific to how they spent the money in FY 2022, and handout number 4 is for FY 2021. If there are no further questions, I'll move on to the last slide of the presentation.
Looks like one question from Senator Begich.
Just if I could shift back for a moment to to page 20, Lacey. In the Gear 2 money, you indicate that the $8.1 million government supplement allocation is 2.8, but he hasn't determined how that's going to be allocated. Do we have an idea of how that's going to be allocated? Just a general idea? Or just you said consistent with his state of the state. Is that right?
Through the chair, Senator Bakich, consistent with the state of the state was in reference to the summer school program earlier in the conversation. I have not received, or the department has not received, guidance on how the 2.8. It does, the governor does have a longer time period. I'm not going to go off my memory, but I believe he has a year to obligate and award this funding. I think it's just too soon to say how the governor is going to allocate it.
So, Mr. Chairman, I would just ask that the commissioner and the department provide that to the committee when we know so that we know how that money is being spent.
Did you hear that, Director Sanders?
Chair Holland, yes, and we will provide the committee an update with that information when it's available.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And I believe no more questions. So, okay. Slide 22.
Okay, so lastly on slide 22, I just wanted to note other funding allocations that the Department of Education and Early Development has received. Under the Child Nutrition Program, the state received an award of $42.2 million for a variety of food service programs. As of July 29th, 2021, a total of $28.3 million had been expended. This funding did have a limited period of availability. It was available from March 2020 through September 2020. And it's also important to note that these funds supplanted the department's regular federal funds. They were not in addition to those federal funds, meaning the department didn't spend its federal funds. It spent these in lieu, and the remaining receipts would lapse. The libraries, archives, and museums received $66,100 from the Institute of Museum and Library Services to award grants to museums and libraries in Alaska. And as of January 29th, 2021, $63,500 had been awarded. Lastly, the Alaska State Council on the Arts received an award of $421,500 to provide Alaska artists with grants, and as of January 29th, 2021, $385,800 had been awarded. And that concludes my prepared presentation, and I am available for any additional questions before turning the presentation back over to Director Heidi Teschner.
Any final questions for Director Sanders?
Sure.
Question from Senator Stevens.
Yeah, well, if you go back to summer schools, I don't know if you're the right person to answer this, Lacey, but I am really concerned that that's just a few months away from us right now, and that could be the harbinger of success or failure for students. Many students have disappeared, and that summer program is going to be essential that they have that opportunity. I have no concern as far as the larger districts being able to handle this. They're making plans now, I know. But I am concerned about the smaller districts and how they are going to prepare for the summer programming. And I'd just like to know further what the department is going to do. How are you going to make sure that these smaller districts are prepared, that somebody's prepared to assist them, to give them advice, so the students in the smallest districts will be able to have a successful summer program? I'll be watching that carefully, and I think it's really an important issue, Lacey. Thank you.
Chair Holland, if I may turn it over to Commissioner Johnson to address just briefly.
That'll be fine. Thank you.
Thank you again for the record, Michael Johnson, Commissioner of Education. Through the chair, Senator Stevens, thank you for the question. So that's something the department's been thinking about and working on even before we knew this other round of money was coming. And so, as you noted, some districts will need more or different kind of support than others. And so our school improvement team, our a system of school support team has been working on ways to support districts, everything from helping put together like almost a summer school in a box that we can send and say, you know, here's suggested recommended curriculum that we know is good curriculum. Here's suggested scheduling, a checklist of here's things you have to do to get it going and prepared. And then, you know, individual supports. Some districts may need all the above. Some districts may not. Some districts may be going through a transition in leadership, and so we want to be there to really support those kids during that transition where leadership may be changing. And then other districts may need, you know, less support in terms of curriculum suggestions and things like that. So we are actively working on that and readying information and resources to send out and offer to districts. In addition, I know the Comp Center through CERC is hosting webinars that will be supportive of this, as well as the Alaska Staff Development Network. So we are gathering all that, and we'll be supporting districts as they begin that process of planning here, even in the coming weeks before the month's over.
Thank you, Commissioner. Follow-up.
Thank you, Commissioner. I had every confidence that you were preparing for this and prepared for it, and it's so important. Only a few months left, and so I hope you'll keep us in the know on what's going on and how it's working to particularly reach those smaller districts. Thank you, Commissioner.
And a question from Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, we've been talking about COVID in this last element, the COVID relief package. And I'm just wondering if the department has done any review of what impact on the receipt of federal dollars or any of these, you know, actions that in expending federal dollars, what impact we would have if we are no longer under an emergency order. Have you given that some thought, and do we know what the impact will be on February 14th if we don't have an order in place or even later this year on receipt of future federal monies and the current monies that we currently have?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, I can ask the Department of Law. I know we have asked some of those questions, and I'll give one example, but as you know, there's even more money almost certainly coming from the federal government, even a larger port. The proposal is, and what is widely thought to be coming is even more support than it was the last CARES package. And so we are not aware of any hindrance to districts receiving that money based on a declaration. What is or could be an issue is last year the governor allowed districts to carry over more than 10% of their funding, because as you heard, all of this CARES Act money is available for multiple years. And so the governor waived that so that districts could carry over more than 10%. I will strongly recommend that happens again. He only can do that under a disaster declaration. Otherwise, the legislature will have to pass statute that allows districts to do that, because that gives them the ability to use all these resources together in a way that they can stretch out the benefit. We also applied for every waiver possible for them to carry over federal money, which many of them did. And I think in some of the coming slides, Director Teschner is going to show some of that. So to summarize all that, the only impact I know would be the inability to carry over above the 10%, which many districts most certainly would need to do to make the maximum benefit out of this money.
Thank you, Commissioner. With no further questions, I believe we're on slide 23, district snapshots, and we're going to pass it back to Director Teschner.
That is correct.
All right, please proceed.
Again, for the record, Heidi Teschner, Director of Finance and Support Services. So I am going to, the following 11 slides basically provide you with a closer look at the average daily membership and foundation formula funding totals.
As well as the COVID-19 federal relief funding and the 2020 operating fund balance data for the 11 districts that you will have before you on Wednesday and Friday of this week. Note that I say 11 districts, and you're only going to have 10 superintendents because one superintendent oversees two districts. I will not go, I'm not planning to go into great detail about each of the 11 slides, but I do want to address the first one to be able to explain what is showing, what we are showing for you. So if we can move on to slide 24.
Please proceed.
Okay, so the table at the top of slide 24 is the same layout that we saw on slide 12 for the statewide data, but this one is just for the district listed. So this particular district, Aleutian Region School District. And then there are two tables at the bottom of the slide. The left-hand side shows the CARES Act allocation expenditures as of January 28th, 2021, and their percent spent, as well as the CRISA Act, or CERSA Act, excuse me, allocations, expenditures, and that percent spent. School districts, I wanted to note that have not actually received their CERSA Act money yet, have not submitted a budget for that, so no districts have actually spent any of that. I also wanted to note out, in particular, for Aleutian Region School District, they do not accept Title I funds, so they actually don't qualify for CERSA Act allocation. But we have, the department has given out of the state's reservation funds funding, additional funding for Aleutian Region, as well as two other districts, Pelican and Skagway, who are both not Title I schools, so also not eligible to receive that funding. So they have additional funding to assist with COVID-19 expenditures that the other districts are going to have the CERSA Act money for. And then on the lower right-hand side of the table on slide 24, that's the fiscal year 2020 operating fund ending fund balance detail broken out between the reserved and unreserved portions, as well as showing the unreserved fund balance percent. As the commissioner stated, the governor waived the statute and regulation that allowed districts to carry over more than 10% of their ending fund balance, unreserved fund balance in fiscal year 2020. And so those are, you know, we're showing those on in this slide. Not all districts had enough to go over the 10%, but in total, of the 43 districts, that 26 districts reported having more than 10% unreserved fund balance carried from fiscal year 20 into 21. So that's additional carryover that districts can use to help offset enrollment reductions and or additional COVID relief expenditures. And so this is the layout you're going to see for each of the 11 districts through slide 34. And then on slide 35 is our contact information. And we just welcome any other questions the committee may have.
Question from Senator Muchiki.
So I don't know if we're going back to the commissioner, but in this particular piece on the CERSA funding, that application period opens on February 15th, I believe. Is that correct?
That is correct, through the chair.
So this doesn't give us a complete snapshot, considering there's almost 144 million that will be available through the CERSA funding. Do we have any idea what that interest level looks like and how that would affect sort of the bottom line on the individual districts, or is that not something that you've collected data on so far, and what sort of assuming some sort of proportion to the different districts?
Through the chair, Senator Muchiki, if I'm understanding your question right, so we do know, we don't know exactly how districts want to spend their money. We don't have that data yet because they have not submitted, the application is not open yet. We could assume that they're going to follow similarly to what they have spent
and how they've spent things in CARES, but again, it's up to the district to know for sure. Once we get that budget information, we can know for sure how they're planning to spend the money. I don't know if that's answering your question.
Mr. Chairman, I can take it offline. It's just on that $144 million, if it's applied somewhat similarly, allocation proportional or proportionally with the other allocations, I'm assuming that that is going to change the bottom line significantly on each district. And I understand that the bottom line is not really the bottom line, but when I think about how legislators, so, and that's why I wanted to go back sort of to the commissioner, legislators, many, and the folks in the community sort of couldn't believe that the districts would ask for a hold harmless when the population they were serving was dramatically reduced just because of COVID. However, I don't think people are aware that the hold harmless provision is law. That's not a request that's outside of what's sitting in statute today. So I'm trying to bring together what the ultimate sort of bottom lines may look like for the various districts and still sort of make constituents aware that hold harmless is not something that's being asked for this year. You would actually have to change statute for the districts not to be held harmless on the effects of COVID and the reduced ADM. Do you have a comment on that, Commissioner?
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, so I'll try to see if I'm understanding your question. So so the snapshots you have, the first one happens to be Aleutian Region, and it doesn't show any additional care, the second CARES Act money, because it doesn't get Title I money. We made up for that. But like if you go to Bering Straits, it does reflect on the snapshot page the amount of money they will get out of the $143 million, which is $5.1 million there for the second CRRSA Act is what it's called there. And so that is on these sheets, and in your supplements there, you have a breakdown of how much every district's getting from the second round of CARES Act, the $143 million. What we don't know is the exact amount for the third package that is presumably going to pass Congress. In terms of the hold harmless provision, you're absolutely correct. That's in statute. That's been applied and used years before the pandemic. And so that's not a request outside of what has been longstanding practice. When I was a superintendent, our district fell into a hold harmless scenario. And so we were able to use that over the course of 4 years as a gradual step down in funding based on enrollment. So that you're absolutely right. That's not something new. But all of this money together, you know, so districts are funded. Some of them qualify for hold harmless. And then when you add in the federal relief money, which is supposed to help address all these things, then you can look at across the board what the overall impact is for districts. We're still analyzing it. Obviously, there's transportation and other funds to factor in or out. But based on our initial analysis, Superintendents Association, Dr. Parity sent a letter asking that there be a floor based on the FY19 projections and no ceiling or limit to funding. And based on our initial analysis, all but seven districts on operating funds are at or above that floor. But as your question notes, we continue to analyze and look at that and work with the Superintendents Association to determine what the impact is from all of this over the past year.
Thank you, Commissioner. With a question from Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Commissioner. Always a pleasure to be able to chat with you about these things. And it was mentioned earlier about the disaster declaration. and the impact it may have if we don't have a disaster declaration on education. I'd like you to clarify that for me so I fully understand. If the disaster declaration is not in place, and is it my understanding that districts could not use those carryover, they cannot use carryover, they could not carry over funds. So my question is, how important is that? How important is it if we lose that if there is no disaster declaration?
Thank you, through the chair, Senator Stevens. So, you know, it would vary by district, but I would venture to say that it's very impactful. When you think about that there may be another CARES package and how flexible this money is, and the amount of money and then the window to spend it, I think it's very important to give districts this flexibility to manage these resources in a way that will benefit students for the next few years. And I think that's the intent of these relief packages, is that it does address the immediate need, but it also recognizes that, you know, there's going to be an impact because of enrollment and those sorts of things going forward. And so by allowing districts to waive that, you give them the flexibility to manage these funds in the most efficient and effective way possible. We already have districts asking if that's going to be available because they're planning out the rest of the year, they're planning summer schools and that sort of thing with these funds. I'll just add, when I answered the question earlier, it was directly focused on the funding, these federal funds. But I will just note that if there's negative impacts of no disaster declaration in other areas, that will impact schools, whether that be vaccines or testing or whatever. All of that contributes to getting schools reopened. And so though that's not a direct impact under my department and doesn't directly impact the funding, it could impact local school districts depending on the municipality and other folks. And, you know, we could ask for more information on that if it would help the committee.
Thank you, Dr. Johnson. I really do appreciate your response, and I think any information you provide us on the impact of a loss of that declaration would be crucial to us. Thank you.
And another question from Senator Hughes.
Thank you. As follow-up to Senator Stevens' question, Commissioner, we could also make sure, if there weren't a disaster declaration actually extended, that we permitted the schools to carry over more than the 10%. We could fix that statutorily, is my understanding. I wanted to talk about the hold harmless provision, because when you were superintendent, that came into play. But I'm wondering, it's atypical, I think, what we're seeing now, because it's not necessarily the population shrinking in a community and the number of students shrinking in a community, but it's students moving from brick and mortar to correspondence. So in your situation, I'm guessing it was actually a loss of students, so you weren't paying for those students twice. You had a step-down approach because the number of students went down overall. Whereas now what we're seeing is students moving from brick and mortar to correspondence, but they're still there, and the district is, they're still students for the district, they're just not in the brick and mortar school. So as I asked Heidi, the hold harmless would mean we're paying for them under the hold harmless, but we're also paying them at the 90% rate for correspondence. So it is different. Would you not agree?
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Hughes. So correct. And when I was superintendent and hold harmless came into play, it was because of a drop of population in the community, which resulted in a drop of enrollment. In the current situation, which, you know, the current hold harmless statute didn't conceive of a situation like we're in right now. It's not necessarily a drop in population, but a change in enrollment. And so some students have gone from one school to another school, from a brick and mortar to a correspondence program, or they've left a particular district and enrolled in a correspondence program in a different district. And so it does But that's always been possible under the statute. It's just to a greater degree in the current situation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. I believe we've exhausted our questions from the committee. Thank you for the snapshots for the districts we'll be talking with next week. This week. Did you have anything else, Commissioner?
No, thank you. We appreciate the opportunity to be here, and I really appreciate that the committee is giving districts time later this week, because they certainly will come with additional information specific to their districts and how this is impacting them.
Thank you, Commissioner, and your directors. Our next meeting will be on Wednesday, February 10th at 9 a.m. We'll continue this conversation with some of the superintendents from around the state. I recommend members bring today's presentation and handouts with them for reference. Is there any other business for the committee? Hearing none, this committee is adjourned at 10:31.